Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
It's Talker!
Welcome to Talker Live! White City Soho House.
Yes, that is a lovely reaction. How are you today, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling like a moth to a flame.
Ooh.
Which is also a Janet Jackson song, because you know that I love my music.
Yes.
Like a moth to a flame.
Big Janet fan, yep.
Because I have always been like a moth to a flame to art, and in particular to a certain kind of thing that got me into art, which is the mythologies surrounding artists. Because, as everybody knows, if you've listened to Talk Art, I love Frida Kahlo.
Yes.
And a big part of that was the narrative behind the work, because I actually knew all about her life story before getting into her art. Because back in the 90s, it was impossible to actually see her work, because apart from tiny, like, black and white photographs here and there, her work wasn't really that well distributed.
How did you find out about her work, though, Rob?
I went to the library and found a book written by Hayden Herrera, and it was an a biography written about her life. And it was the stories of survival and also kind of political, social change elements of her life story, which connected to me at that young age of like 13 or something, or 12 or 13, when I first started reading about her. And I loved the resistance and the kind of fire in her belly and the way that she had no fear, effectively.
That's what you've got.
Yeah, I didn't actually at that age, but I do now. Now I'm like trouble.
now
I've got my boxing gloves on. Now I'm a rural gay. I have this T-shirt tonight that says "Rural Gay" by Philip Normal.
There we go,
Philip. Yeah.
Yes, lovely. So anyway, let's talk about our guest who's coming on.
So our guest tonight has written the most amazing book. It's called Bright Stars: Great Artists Who Died Too Young. And it's actually, this tonight isn't exclusive because the book isn't even in the shops yet.
But you can buy it here at the end if you're in the room, not on the live stream.
Exactly. It comes out on Tuesday. And we love this book because, just like that story of Frida Kahlo, it talks about artists that a bit different to Frida, but they died too young, but they have the most amazing life stories. And in such short periods of time, they've pretty much gone on to affect change and be remembered for art history and, you know, for future generations to connect with.
Yep.
Some of them only worked for like 10 years. And then the impact that those 10 years have is remarkable.
Exactly.
And I really recommend buying this book, reading it, because as we'll discover tonight, there are some extraordinary stories.
But as well as being an author, our guest is a TV presenter, a curator, a mentor, but also we are in Soho House in White City, and our guest is the head of collections at Soho House. Whenever you visit a Soho House, you'll see on the walls, you'll be drawn to so many different artworks, and our guest tonight is across most of that, across the world, which is an incredible thing.
So global.
So we would like to welcome to Talk Art,
Kate Bryan. And I can't tell you how happy we are to finally be able to say your name on this show, because we were supposed to do an interview in 2019.
On your other book.
When Art of Love came out, Kate's first book, because Bright Stars is actually her second book. And what happened, Kate?
Well, I had quite a good excuse, but I couldn't make it. We had to cancel everything because my waters broke a month early. So I was in hospital. But Juno is here and she's my little bright star. And I, she's forgiven.
What does it feel like for us to be interviewing you? Because this is something that you normally do as a presenter on Portrait Artist of the Year, Landscape Artist of the Year. You are normally used to interviewing other people.
Yeah, no, it's quite strange. I woke up this morning thinking, oh, I'm really looking forward to seeing the guys. And I thought, oh, what are they going to ask me? And you relinquish control. But, you know, I know you guys are big art geeks like me. And the idea that you'd read my book was really thrilling. The idea that anyone reads your book, it's funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
You kind of don't write a book unless you think someone's going to read it, like all our poor mums. But that actually that your friends and your colleagues and people you admire are going to read something you wrote.
Yeah.
It's really
quite revealing, isn't it?
Yeah, you guys must have experienced that with your amazing book.
We did. It's been an incredible experience. Yeah, but this is your second book. So when we were saying we was meant to interview in your first book in 2019, Art of Love, which is about couples historically in the history of art who have made art together or been artists that have got together. It is a fascinating, brilliant book. Everyone should buy both of these books. But this second book, again, is building on that, which is about these nuances which you discover. These are artists that a lot of people would know, but artists that are new discoveries to myself and to many people. But you manage to find these nuggets of gold that really, I've got lists and lists here that I'm going to just throw out during the interview of things that I'm like, that is fascinating, that is amazing. How do you go about finding the research for the artists, and why do you choose certain artists?
Yeah, I think drawing up the list of artists is a really thrilling part of the job, but also kind of a scary one because you're kind of committing to them and you're committing that you're going to put your heart and soul on paper. And you're also trying to put together a tapestry because I do always want these books to be able to be dipped into. You know, I don't really feel like you need to have an art background to come to art. And I say that over and over again. So I need to put my money where my mouth is that really feel, I honestly want everyone to be able to read this. So you could just pick up one chapter and then, you know, 6 months later, pick up another one. And it wouldn't matter that they weren't necessarily threaded together directly. And there are themes in the book that try and make it easier. But when you are putting the list together, you do have to think about how am I best being representative? How am I best addressing the holes in art history? How am I helping people who are underrepresented? But also how am I allowing the reader to come to artists that we think we know really well in a different way? Mm. Because we are all victims of sensationalism, of kind of being attracted to nihilism. You know, like everyone wants to tell us these stories about artists and they want to tell us for a reason. You know, they live fast, they burn bright, the same way that people talk about rock stars. And so it's actually like, well, actually there's a great nuance to that practice and we shouldn't really look at that artist's career solely through the prism of their death because it does them a disservice. So it's trying to be sensitive. So when I put the list together, it's really fun, but sometimes someone doesn't land in the book and you're like, no, but you know, you have to, I'm trying to always sort of do a big spread of art history. It's like 500 years of art history. For me, obviously there always has to be loads of women, loads of artists who come from underrepresented backgrounds. So it just means that some people won't make the cut because I've already got someone from London in the 1990s. So I don't need to, right. Yeah.
But you have set yourself the rule that every artist in this book is under 40. There's a couple that just peek over that. Yeah. But that I like the fact I'm about to turn 40 and the fact that that's still young. So that's really good.
Yes, yes. And but you know, I've lived longer than nearly everybody in this book. And that's so weird. But no, I was not very ruthless. I was like, right, it's 40 and that's it. You know, it takes 2 decades to make a career. You don't become an artist till you're in your 20s. And so that's young, 2 decades. And then I was like, Mapplethorpe was 43. Oh no. Vermeer, well, I'm not going to not have them. So I had to sort of write to my editor and say, is it okay to
cheat your own rules.
I don't know. What's the rules on that?
That's what I really like about the book, though, is that you include people like Caravaggio. You have all these kind of very iconic names that people are going to immediately recognize. But you also have people that I'd never even heard about. And considering that I spent most of my time thinking about art, it was fascinating.
Oh, dude, I hadn't heard of them either. Like, it's not like I'm like some walking encyclopedia. No, I like dig them out. It's like being an archaeologist. And then you do this weird thing where you go around exhibitions. I shouldn't really admit this. Go around exhibitions, just living your normal life, going to see art shows, and then really liking the work that you're seeing. And then going to the caption, and just looking at what date they died and what date they were born and working it out and going, stop being so dark. just let people
live their lives, did they die young?
And be a normal artist. Oh, why are you so obsessed?
You were kind of hoping that they died young.
I wasn't, but yes, please be dead. But I'm talking about people a couple of hundred years ago. So I discovered Joanne Boyce Wells at the exhibition in London, which was about putting women back into the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood. You know, Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, patriarchal in its very title as a movement, excluded women. But there were all these women involved, not just muses, not just mistresses, but artists. So, and I discovered Joanna Boyce Wells and was like, okay, great. You know, this is a total new discovery in the middle of this exhibition. Did I do a little fist pump when I saw that she died young? Not in a weird way, but in a kind of like,
well on. Yeah.
I want one of these women in the book because this work is so moving to me, and I want to know who these women were in Victorian society that laid the groundwork for women today to be in practicing artists and being in art schools. And it was those women who were the first to do it, defying all convention, defying their family wishes, like being socially stigmatized. And we owe them a debt of gratitude. So yeah, if I could get them into this book, I was pleased.
Yeah. Well, Rob mentioned Caravaggio, so you would know of the name Caravaggio. You probably picture Caravaggio paintings, but you don't actually know a lot about his life. And this is one of the tidbits that I got, that Caravaggio died when he was 38, but while he was on the run for a murder. So he murdered someone, and he illegally was walking around with a sword, which you couldn't do in them days, and I'd assumed that that was common practice.
You couldn't do it in them days. You can't do it now.
But no, you're right. You couldn't do it anyway, but I just assumed then that everyone had a sword, you know, and a big hat. But he was on the run for a murder.
Yeah. So Caravaggio is the ultimate bad boy of art history. Like, he had a bad temper. He was an outsider, a self-styled outsider. I think you could describe him as sort of being in with kind of gang culture, honestly.
Yeah.
And all those amazing paintings you see, which, speak to people and touched people that at the time that they were painted. You know, people went to churches to see his paintings unveiled. Like, he was a star. And like, young artist called Artemisia Gentileschi, who's now one of our most beloved women artists from the Baroque period, she saw them when she was a teenager. And it transformed her thinking about art. But Caravaggio wanted to make art that spoke to real people. So he wanted to bring those stories from the Bible to life. And he did that through the sort of verisimilitude of his painting, by which I mean like to make these things look real. Christ with dirty feet. He would have had dirty feet if he was wandering around with no shoes on. Like, and to show people really in pain and really in anguish. And
he also used like local prostitutes that people recognized.
He
put their faces onto Mary.
Exactly. And that sort of took that realism to the next level, which is like, actually, you know what? If we're talking about Mary Magdalene, she's the ultimate sinner saint for these people. So yeah, I'd take a prostitute who I know. He may even well have been a sort of a semi-pimp at this point as well, and put her recognizable facial features into this painting. And so he's an extraordinary person, like transforms art history, but kind of goes out of fashion. That's the thing I'm trying to get at with these books. You can be at the center of your art world. You can be in every major show. You can be lauded by the greatest critics of the day. Man, woman, doesn't matter. But if your legacy is not protected, it's this tiny little flame and it can be extinguished so quickly. And someone like Caravaggio today, who we would all lay down in the road to own a painting, that's just so important. 40 paintings survive. He transformed all of European painting. Totally falls out of fashion in the Victorian period. It's just too real for them. You know, Ruskin's like, oh, he's gross. And so it's like...
Ruskin was the critic of the day.
And he's just not having any of it. And so it's only in like the mid-20th century that this amazing art historian, Robert Longin, lavishes attention on him, teaches his students about him. One of his students is Pasolini, the film director, who then takes that Caravaggio aesthetic, these dramatic light and shade, plunging the subjects into these spotlights, which weren't even invented then, and then puts that in his cinema. And slowly, we get this fetish for Caravaggio. But when I was at university, we didn't study him.
Wow.
I'm not that old.
Yeah.
And so it's like, that's what I'm trying to do with this book, is like, we have to protect these artists' legacies, because they might fall away from us and they mean so much.
And actually, in the final chapter, there's five kind of sections of the book, and in the final one it's called Unfinished Stories. And one of the things I really connected to was Pauline Boti's story, who is an amazing artist. And the reason we know about her is because we've interviewed Caroline Kuhn before, who's the amazing painter. She's currently, if you live in London, as our audience do, she's in the Hayward Gallery group show called Mixing It Up. And she actually paints with Pauline's paints. I think after Pauline's death, Caroline was gifted her paintbrushes and paints from Pauline's husband as a kind of message to say, Caroline, you're the next generation.
Carry on.
And now she's gone on, you know, 50 years later to be in the Hayward herself. So she's, you know, an extraordinary painter. But can you talk a bit about Pauline? Because she's someone, like you said about Caravaggio, disappearing for a long time.
I think
who became unknown.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the greatest crimes for me is that, you know, Pauline Boty was like... She was mistreated, really, because she was beautiful and charismatic as well as a great artist. And that was difficult in 1960s London. You know, it's just so sexist. She wasn't even allowed to go on the painting course, actually. She was put on the stained glass window making course because women weren't allowed on the painting course.
Right.
So she's sort of defying all of these things and becomes this amazing artist. And she's a star of London, but they kind of denigrate her. They call her the Bardot of Wimbledon, because that's where she went to college. She grew up in Carl Shorten, actually, where my husband's from. It's like the only time I ever saw Carl Shorten in a book. And,
I think he was on the bill once.
Yeah, probably. And yeah, so she's, you know, when Bob Dylan arrives in London for the first time, they're like, get Pauline to take him round. She's like got all of London in the palm of her hand. When the Beatles are on TV, she interviews them. Yeah. She's got a walk-on part in Alfie, but she's also an amazing artist. She's in all the major pop art shows. Her first solo exhibition sells out. I mean, in the 1960s, art exhibitions didn't sell out, especially for a woman. She's on this amazing, groundbreaking documentary called Pop Goes the Weasel. And yet, she dies. She dies very young. She's pregnant. During a 4-month scan for her pregnancy, they tell her she has cancer. She refuses the radiotherapy because otherwise there's a great risk, obviously, to the unborn child. Has the baby. Does the treatment afterwards. Unfortunately, it's not effective. And she's in hospital. She's smoking weed. The Rolling Stones come, pay her a visit. She draws them. I mean, like, this woman.
It's so extraordinary. And the thing about her is as well, like, you think of that whole era, like pop art or like, you know, the British kind of art that was being made at that time. You immediately think of like Peter Blake, or you even think of maybe like Richard Hamilton or all these kind of other artists.
But Hockney.
Yeah, Hockney, exactly. But I'd never really thought about Pauline Boty.
Yeah, there were so many women pop artists, and that was actually sort of sewn into its DNA. You know, it was democratic. It was reflecting the society that it was in. Women, you know, she said some really amazing feminist stuff on TV as well. She said something like, you know, women are raging in the streets and you're scared of us. You know, she's like, we're amazing. And her paintings are so interesting. And I think even more interesting for me than some of artists who I admire greatly at that period. Peter Blake's a great friend of mine. Of course, I love Hockney. But there's something about seeing the perspective of a woman at that time grappling with the way that their women are being objectified. So you've got them so objectified in magazines, but in reality, they're fighting for their rights. And the contrast, the duality is so strong, and it comes across in the paintings so well. And so you look at her paintings now, and you're like, they're sensational. She dies, her husband dies 12 years later, so there's no one really to protect her legacy. And then the paintings are literally uncovered in a barn. It's a total twist of fate. There's this young teenager, he watches that documentary that she's in, Pop Goes the Weasel. When he grows up, he's an art historian. He's like, I wonder whatever happened to that Pauline Boty that I saw in that documentary. Tracks down her work. His name's David Allen Meller. Someone give him a medal. And he finds the paintings in this barn, puts on his big show in the Barbican in 1991, at which point everybody should have said, sorry, us, the art establishment, have let a really important artist fall through the cracks who perfectly reflects the society at that time. But it's still taking ages for anyone to come to her. The Tate have now got her work on permanent display, which is great. Ali Smith, the author, put her in one of her fiction books as a character. But I guess that's my point. It's like, it doesn't really matter who you are. You can fall between the cracks, and you're a hell of a lot more likely to do so if you're a woman or you're an artist of colour or from an underrepresented background. And it's, you know, who writes the canon of art history? Well, we all do. We all have a part to play in it. So it's like we all have to get on board with these artists.
I also loved the fact that her work, you know, you mentioned that she was put on a stained glass kind of design course or something. Her paintings actually then took influence from that experience.
Yeah, it's like, and screw you, I'm going to make better paintings.
Yeah.
You put me on that course, I'll put it back in my painting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And she kind of used the design of like breaking up stained glass into different colours into the way that she would use the canvas and so on. It's really, really radically cool.
So talking about legacies, do you then feel a responsibility now to these artists and feel like you're someone that can champion and make sure these legacies are protected?
Yeah, poor them. It's like me just wandering around going, hey, don't forget. But no, I do. And I think that's why, you know, I always try and think about, you know, put Van Gogh on the cover. great, that's helpful. But, you know, Khadija Say is on the cover because this is someone whose legacy is so tender and so absolutely vital for us to protect.
Well, let's talk about Khadija then, if we're going to mention that. I saw her work. She's an artist who grew up in West London and in a council estate, in a tower block. And she started making work. And I saw the work at the Victoria Miro Gallery in an Isaac Julian curated show. And it was 9 tintype photographs of herself with community paraphernalia, ephemera, that she's sort of posed with. Beautiful photographs, look like they're from another century. But her story is so touching, if we can talk about her story. And I'm so thrilled that you've written about her, but it's such a moving story.
Yeah, it was definitely one of the hardest things to write because it's so raw and because it's so moving. And it was in discussion, obviously, with the family and with the estate that I put it in the book. But yeah, her family are from the Gambia. And she's born here in the UK, and she sort of fights against the system, basically. You know, so she's not from a well-off family at all. She has these parents who put her in these great after-school clubs, and she works her way through. She's such a sort of distinguished person, really. Must have had real charisma about her, even as a teenager. She wins a scholarship to go to rugby, which is like one of the most prestigious, you know, schools in the country. And she's there, and then she goes to Farnham University. She gets a photography degree. She puts work into this like graduate show, which Nicola Green was a judge on. Nicola Green's an artist and a great champion for supporting other young artists. She's married to the MP David Lammy. And so she meets her at the opening night. And Khadija's this amazing mix, apparently, and everyone I spoke to said this, of being like really sort of humble and maybe a bit shy, you could say, didn't take up much space, but at the same time, really wanting to know, like, how do you become an artist? Someone tell me. I just want to know. I'm making the great work, but I need to know how I'm going to do this. How do I do this without very much money or connections? She's working in a care home. Nicola takes her into the studio. She becomes her mentor. She works for her as well as working in the care home. Anyway, she has this amazing opportunity to go to Venice Biennale as on a program to support young artists and curators. And she goes and she sees like Lorna Simpson's work in the flesh for the first time. Can't believe it. And then a couple of years later, amazingly, her work gets selected to go into this new diaspora pavilion, which is kind of like a rebuttal against this like crazy centuries old nationalistic way of presenting art, which is a bit weird, isn't it? But anyway, we love it. But as a thing, Venice Biennale, but sometimes it's like, wow, okay. So the diaspora pavilion was like super exciting. Established artist Isaac Julian, Hugh Locke, Yinka Shonabert, and then these young artists. And she sort of won her place with this amazing work that you were describing, Russell. There's like tin type photography. So like basically using wet plate photography, which is just a medium so fraught with risk. And they're very personal. They sort of speak about her spiritual background. She plays these roles. She uses these beautiful objects.
They belong to her family, didn't they? These spiritual objects.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they're just sensational images of the, like, you know, and people were stopped in their tracks. People had no idea who she was, whether she was emerging, established, whatever. People like Valdemar Januszczak does his review of Venice and puts her in, you know, and like Mark Wadber, a really seasoned collector, sees them and was like, oh, I want to buy them. And like everyone just responded so strongly to the work. She gets back from Venice and then she's effectively murdered by the system in the Grenfell Tower, which is so close to here. And that was like for her to have made it in that way against all the odds, and for her life to be cut short is so tragic. It doesn't make any sense. But the point is that there's so much that's been done in her name, and even she was an activist in her time wanting to work with other people. And so we only have the promise of the work that she could have made, but we do have the responsibility to say that we have this art world which is really, really sort of systemically got problems with class and gender and race. And there's so much beautiful things to say about our art world, but there's so much more work we need to do on it all the time, all of us collectively together. And so, you know, I think we have to take her story, and as Nicola says so beautifully, it's a quote in the book, you know, she's an inspiration for other young artists.
Yes.
if I won't let her be Pauline Boaty, a lot of people won't let her be Pauline Boaty, and Pauline Boaty is now not Pauline Boaty. Do you know what I mean? Like we have a responsibility to revise art history. There's so much space. We don't have to just have all these like old white straight men. So much space. We like them. There's loads of company for them, and they're coming.
Yeah, totally. And for those listening in right now, you should look up the work called Dwelling in This Space We Breathe, which was from 2017. And it's a series of 9 self-portraits, as they were describing. And the objects, these spiritual objects in the work, were actually partly owned, I think, by her mother and father as well. So it's a deeply personal kind of work. Extraordinary.
So talking about white straight men, let's talk about Van Gogh, because he is on the cover. And talking about legacies, he was an artist that may have disappeared if it hadn't been for his brother's wife, his sister-in-law. And all of his work, everything we know of Van Gogh, was made in 10 years. In only 10 years, everything we have on this planet was made in that timescale. It just blows your mind.
I was so shocked by that.
Yeah.
I didn't actually realise that.
Yeah, no, he's a late starter, bless him. If anyone in this room's in their late 20s, you've got, still got time. You've got loads. You could be Van Gogh. You've got loads of time to totally reinvent yourself. He's such a special artist. And he's my favourite artist. Like, I get so embarrassed to say it, because like, you're supposed to be super cool and like global art world. It's like, who's your favourite artist? Van Gogh. Yeah. But he's really the artist that, when I was a child, was like, blew my mind. And it really allows me to tap back into that.
Did you see it in the flesh anywhere when you were a kid?
I don't think so.
Just
no.
Books.
I didn't really go to museums and galleries when I was a kid. I came to it late. Yeah. So and so I think what's so special about Van Gogh is, he's an artist that is able to touch people. He did what he set out to do. He purposefully wanted to create pictures that transcended time, space, money, religion, everything. He wanted to just touch people directly. And he was one of the first artists to really try and imbue his paintings with psychological feeling, which is such a modern thing. Mm. And he didn't come to art till late. Yeah, you say 10 years, 900 paintings, 2,000
works. But he only sold one in
his lifetime.
And then his sister-in-law had all of the paintings in her tiny
apartment.
Which is
a bit of a burden for
her. Of a burden. Someone said, get rid of them, chuck them out, burn them to give yourself some space.
Yeah.
She was like, no, I'm going to do this. But if she wasn't around, we wouldn't know Van Gogh.
Yeah, she's the real torchbearer, and she's a hero, and they're just starting to uncover more about her. Someone's just publishing a book about her. She's unbelievable. Like, she was a real mover and shaker. She made herself like this amazing art dealer. It's totally not her background. She sold 200 paintings. She got the Samuel Courtauld, to buy the sunflowers and then give it to the National Gallery. She was so wicked, and she is so responsible for his career, just like David Alan Mellor helped with Pauline Boty. But the thing that I wanted to do with Van Gogh is sort of set the record straight. You know, the Hollywood gave us this vision of him in Lust for Life as this madman, you know, it's like eating his paint and sort of like running around and in a frenzy and painting like this. And actually, of course, he was mentally unwell. We know that. He was a great artist despite his ill health. And he painted when he was well, and his painting kept him going. And it was like in the asylum in San Remy, when he was better for a few months, he painted some of his most brilliant paintings. Mm. And actually, to sort of tie him up in this mythology of his death, he cut off his ear and then he shot himself, is just to do total disservice to someone who was extremely well-read, extremely well-liked by the art community. Monet, Pizarro, Degas, Manet were buying his work after his death, went to his funeral.
Yeah, well, you talk about sunflowers.
Yeah.
Gauguin, who is his friend, sold 2 sunflower paintings. I got this from your book. To Degas, who bought 2 of the paintings.
Well, he's not a mad outsider. He's a real, like, it's not unusual not to sell paintings in your lifetime at that point. Had he lived longer, I do think he would have been selling his works, and I do think he would have been allowed into the inner sanctum of the art world. He would have found it tough. He was definitely...
Well, they didn't want to put shows on because they were like, this is a madman. Why are you putting these shows on?
Exactly.
This is bad.
But the thing is, he was so much more than what we've been told, and I think it's a lot to do with that movie. You know, like, the myth has come through so strongly in society. It was on cinema for 37 weeks. It won an Oscar, won a Golden Globe. This is Lust for Life. I think it came out in like 1957.
It's Kirk Douglas, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So I just wanted to sort of say there's so much more to Van Gogh than these things that you know about him. I'm glad you know his name, and I'm glad you're looking at his painting, but please understand the sensitivities of this man's practice.
Something that really strikes me with Van Gogh as well is, if you look at all these artists, one of the reasons why they were able to have such an impact in a very short number of years is that drive, that kind of... It's like an irrepressible kind of passion for painting or for expressing yourself through photography or whatever the medium is, they all share these kind of traits. And even though if you actually read out all of these artists like Heath Herring, Jean-Michel Basquiat, you know, Francesca Woodman, Anna Mendieta, like you read them through, you immediately know all their work if you, like us, and you spent like years looking at stuff. But what I mean is it's quite singular, like all of these artists' work. It's instantly recognizable. They had their own language, their own kind of voice. But the thing is that they were kind of obsessed with creating and they would make loads of work. And I think these days there's this thing where people try and stop themselves from making too much work because they're so aware of like an art market or the perceived badness. If it, you know, if you make 10 paintings in a year, that's too many, or you know, or 100 or whatever it may be. But I think people should just let themselves create how they want to create, and like these stories are proof of that, you know.
Yeah, I think what the book at several points touches upon the development and how the art market became more sophisticated. And, you know, there is a difference between artists and the art market. You know, one is about business and one is about selling myths, which is why these myths come to be. One is about selling the attractiveness of nihilism or whatever in other people. But it sort of intersects with the book, and sometimes you see someone totally shunning the market. You know, a lot of the people in the book actually did try and shun the market. So, you know, Basquiat, you know, he really had a distaste for the way that he was held up as this poster boy for rich, greedy 1980s New York. He could see what was happening as it was happening. Someone like Keith Haring tried to completely circumnavigate the art market by having his shop and letting everybody have his art. You see it over and over again, actually.
I loved Keith Haring's story because in your chapter, you talk about this idea that he always knew he was going to die young. And it reminded me when I used to make music, like there were musicians I knew who would talk like that. That I think some young creative people have this kind of like romantic vision of like heartbreak and like destruction and death, and there's some kind of like romance around all of that.
Yeah, it's almost like a kind of, you know, the pleasure pain circle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he had this instinct in him basically that he was going to die young. He didn't even know how he was going to die in the end, you know, from HIV and AIDS. But it was that one of the driving forces behind his work and why he made so much work and why he wanted it to be like everywhere, you know, that kind of, you know, drive that he had. And I was never really aware of that.
Yeah, no, I actually just watched this amazing documentary about him. It's just literally coming out. I think it's called Street Boy or something. Anyway, it's the latest documentary you can find on Keith Haring. Watch it. It's absolutely incredible. And you see all this archival footage of him at college, yeah, taking up all the corridors, like painting the floor, painting the walls, like just this absolutely insatiable desire to create. And they struck upon this language, which is so universal. You know, the beating heart and the radiant baby and these very sort of almost hieroglyphic, simplistic, colourful, joyful imagery, which could be very easily dismissed as being kind of not fine art, not high art, not serious enough. And actually, there's just something so powerful and magnetic about him as an artist and also as a person. And I was, yeah, I'm really struck by his story because he fought so hard for art to be accepted by everybody, and by which I mean that everybody should be included, because there's so many walls, and you guys work so hard every day with every podcast and all your books to be the great democrats of the art world. And I feel like your kindred spirit trying to do that, because everybody should be able to come to art. And Keith Haring knew that in the 80s, and we still got the same problem now, you know.
Yeah, it's true. And with his pop shop in New York, for example, apparently back when he was making work, some people really dismissed him.
Oh yeah,
they really thought it was worthless art in a way, because it was so populist and that there was way too much again.
Yeah.
But now, you know, years later, it's become crazy pricey.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the art stands the test of time. It's never, you know, it's the art that will stand the test of time. And so, yeah, people had such distaste for him because he was everywhere and he was in the nightclubs and, you know, and also he was totally shunned by New York society. He was like invited to everything. He's with, you know, Michael Jackson, Brooke Shields, Madonna, Yoko Ono. He's, you know, being flown around the world on
and Grace Jones, because he painted Grace, didn't he?
He's at this epicenter of it all, and he's one of the first people to come out publicly in a Rolling Stone magazine and say that he's got HIV and talk about it in a really moving way. It's one of the most extraordinary interviews I've ever read. It really holds up. It's
to be that vocal with it was
exactly
really,
and the next day, no invitations, done. Yeah. You know, and then he put all his time and energy to building a foundation. And this is what's so interesting, is that like he secured his legacy. Maybe it's because, as you were saying, Rob, like he knew he was going to die young. He created this legacy, he created this foundation, which meant that you could like, you know, license his images. And he had all of this in place. And they've raised like tens of millions of pounds for charities of his choice, which are usually HIV/AIDS related causes or charities for babies and children. He loved children. And like this guy, the legacy, his impact on the planet is just staggering. Mm. So if I ever hear anyone dismiss Keith Haring, like, oh, you just see it everywhere in all the gift shops, I'm like, great. I am so delighted you're sick of seeing it everywhere. Also, because it's raising millions.
His diaries are amazing as well. Like, have you read his diaries?
Yeah.
If you haven't read his diaries, please buy that book as well as Kate's book. But they're classic. And you also showed me the sculptures in New York.
That's right. We were public artworks everywhere. But what I loved about Keith Haring is he started off on the streets doing street art, but he would go on the subways and do these chalk drawings. And then as he became super famous and selling for loads of money, he would still go back to the subways and do these chalk drawings.
Oh,
but
yeah.
People were then like, there's a Keith Haring. Just to take up all like a Banksy, you know what I mean? It was that sort of vibe that he had.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like Banksy opened his shop in Croydon a couple of years ago. I mean, let's not forget that basically Keith Haring opened a door that thousands of artists are walking through. In fact, millions, because actually like Instagram artists, I mean, Keith Haring would like own Instagram now.
Yeah, totally. You would have loved that. So one of the chapters the chapter that resonates the most with me was called Battles and Salvation. And there was an artist which I'd never heard of, but thanks to your book, I now know lots about. And her name is Charlotta Salomon. And can you speak a bit about her? Because honestly, I'm so moved by her story. And can I quickly say one thing? The thing I love about a lot of these stories is that there are other people mentioned in these write-ups that you've written about them all who have supported the artist and have ensured that their work gets, you know, preserved, restored.
Or created the myth.
Or created the myth, but also encouraged and pushed them on, like kind of spurred them on. And it's one of the most important things, which is kind of why we do talk art, because to love artists when they're alive and just to almost be an audience for them and someone that's giving them feedback. And I think her life story, there's some amazing elements of people who really supported and protected her work.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shocking story, and it's kind of an uncomfortable story, just because it's just so tough. But there's so much about her work, though, which is so all of her work is so uplifting and transcendent and powerful. And she basically created what Griselda Pollock, one of the greatest art historians, said is an event in the history of art. And yet no one knows who she is. I didn't know who she was before I wrote this book, to my shame. I mean, it's just unbelievable. She created this kind of like, it's like a Wagnerian concept, right? So it's like hundreds of gouache paintings. They're small, like a book.
What does Wagnerian mean? As in Wagner?
Wagner, the dude, you know, like the opera dude. Yeah. So like
this, a kind of like, dramatic opus.
Yeah, like total work of art. So like, the way that it looks, the way that it feels, the sound, like the way that it kind of like punches you in the gut. And it's based on like this kind of very folky German thing called a Singspiel, which was a kind of a lesser opera where it was kind of like about a love story and it was comedic, right? So she's tapping into this German heritage at the time that the Third Reich are taking these things of German folklore and turning them and twisting them to fascist goals, right? So she makes this thing. So it's all these paintings and then these like transparent overlays on top on which there are text and sort of directions and like notes about what music you could listen to while you were looking at this. And it's almost like a fresco cycle or a bit more reductively like a graphic novel, but like a fresco cycle, I think. And really special. And it's her kind of autobiography. It's her life story. And it's made in a frenzied, very short period of time. And it's called Life or Theatre? And basically, she's not writing it in the face of her imminent murder at Auschwitz, AIDS, 24, 5 months pregnant. She's writing it in the face of a young person, brokenhearted. She's got all these love stories in it. She's entirely individualistic, but she also suffers from this very difficult family background. And she's deciding really whether to kill herself or whether to devote her life instead to art. And so she devotes her life to art and she makes this thing. And it's her sort of, it's a life raft. It's literally like her oxygen. I will keep living despite everything. She has this horrible abuse in her family that sees her mother, her aunt, and her grandmother all commit suicide. And it's just so tough. But the thing that she makes is just pure creativity. Like, it's spectacular. It's
and also so quite joyous and sort of transcendent.
Yeah.
So, like, if you see what happens to her during her life, you're just like, how can this person still have had hope? You know, it's like you would have thought it would have just been knocked out of her completely. Yeah. But the work is, like, so beautiful.
And what about zeroing in on the power of art? Yeah. Like, we talk about the time all the time. Like, this is the power of art, the redemptive quality of art, how art can save us all. And it's like, it literally did. It was medicine for this woman. It was therapy. It was an escape. And it's there for all of us. And it's never gone away. It's never been hidden in an attic. Her father managed to get hold of it. Her father managed to get her out to the south of France. Unfortunately, just at the moment she got married and registered her marriage,
the Nazis found out the address where they lived, exactly, tracked them down, and then took her to Auschwitz. And because she was pregnant, she was sent straight to the gas chamber.
Yeah.
Because the husband, I think, lived for a few weeks when he arrived there because he was made to work.
Yeah, there's a few assumptions made.
But there was a doctor, wasn't there, who managed to...
So there was this amazing woman called Ottilie Moore, one of the amazing heroes of the 20th century, who rescued loads of Jewish people and particularly babies. Like, I've got this image of her with this, like, car just, like, crammed full of babies, just getting them the hell out of there. Yeah.
And she escaped to Portugal, didn't she?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so during her lifetime, Charlotte had a doctor, which was Ottilie Moore's doctor, and the doctor said, make art. Survive, make art. So she did. She gave it to him, thankfully. And then, unfortunately, she's murdered. Ottilie comes back to the house after the war, and the doctor says, I have this thing for you. Ottilie reunites it with her father, who manages to survive the war, who is friends with Otto Frank and Frank's dad. And I mean, this, what?
And they share their...
Why is this
share
not
the
like...
art,
why yeah. do we not have like a movie, yeah. like a Netflix series? I'm just like, come on, what's missing? Like, why do we see this art all the time?
Well, also, she wrote a letter at the end that was admitting that it was her grandfather who was narcissistic, which caused the suicides of her family members. But she actually ended up murdering her grandfather with a barbiturate omelet, which... tastes quite nice.
She murdered her grandfather,
and then there was a letter poisoned him. So I mean, for the Netflix series, this is great.
It's honestly, it's the most extraordinary story, and it's also it brings to life the point.
It's like, you know, you can't help but laugh at just at the fact that this has been hiding in plain sight. This work exists. It's on display in Amsterdam in the Jewish Historical Society.
But you're saying it's not entered the commercial market.
But it came to display in London in 2019 and Camden. I got to see it, right? But in 18, I think. But the fact is, it needs to be in... We need to keep pushing.
Yeah.
I think it was on display in the RA as well, but a long time ago. We need to keep pushing because, you know, we need to see this. We need to know her name. Because if that is not a singularly, dramatically important perspective on a tumultuous period of history, I don't know what is. Why don't we see this?
And also, when she handed it to the doctor before she got taken away to Auschwitz, she actually said, like, take good care of it. It is my entire life. And she'd wrapped it in brown paper. You know, it was like she was entrusting this person, hoping that that work would survive. And I think the message is that there is love, there is hope, there is kindness, you know, even in the darkest hour. Do you know what I mean? And it's like extraordinary, this kind of energy and belief people can put into objects. You know, that's what really struck me. And that's why I love art. You know, that's what got us here right now, like why we do everything we do. And I think it's a really important thing to remember.
There's a beautiful line in this where you say, it does not live in Hitler's world, talking about her work. It does not live in Hitler's world. It lives and breathes and grows in her own. And that for me felt like such a beautiful line and such a great legacy for her. So talking about myth making, we're going to get on to what you do here in Sorry House, but it's just a few bits that I really love. So there was a critic who talked about Raphael's work, and Raphael died after very amorous shag, and he passed away. And the critic said about this, and that sort of secured his mythology. Right.
Yeah, I mean, Raphael sort of went a bit out of fashion. You know, we all love the kind of muscularity of Michelangelo, the intellectualism of Leonardo.
They hated each other as well.
Oh, yeah. But Raphael maybe would have gone out of fashion if it weren't for the fact that Vasari basically said in his biography, written around the time that he dies at age 37, he had this like night of lovemaking that it was so passionate. He then died. And of course, that was just like this amazing...
We've all been there.
It's just like this amazing... So like, that's his myth, right? That's a much better myth than the one bloody Van Gogh got, right?
Yeah.
But the thing about that is it kind of secured his fate, because in the modern period, people like Picasso made all these works in homage to Raphael, which like really like... I actually use the word pornographic in the book instead of erotic purposefully. Like, they're really, wow, okay. And, you know, there's people like Turner painted him at the Vatican with his mistress. And so it's like they love this idea of him. Yeah. It's this kind of like, you know, if Caravaggio is the bad boy, then it's like Raphael's the real Romeo, you know, like you're not doing it right unless you die in a fever. I mean, it's what? What? Yeah, And it's sort of nonsensical. And there's so much about his work that is so fascinating. And it's kind of, I just was fascinated by that myth of like the great lover.
But if he hadn't done that, we might not know who Raphael is now. It's that tiny little thing that could have changed the course of history.
Yeah, and also don't forget, Michelangelo lives until his late 80s, Leonardo to his late 70s. Why do we say Raphael in the same sentence? Yeah. Like, he dies in his 30s. I mean, that's sort of what actually motivated me to write the book. I was like, how do we know who these people are? I work in the contemporary art world. I spend all my time with artists. I think they're really on a roll. We're really building them an audience. And then you're like, God, it's taking ages. It takes ages. And you are really the lucky artist if you find your audience and have a consistent career and a consistent happy career. You know, it's actually so rare as to make it almost impossible. So I was like, how do I know who Modigliani is? He died in his 20s. He painted for 6 years. I don't know how I know, so I'm going to go find out.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Something I love about the book is that you mention a number of artists that have died within our lifetime. So people like Dash Snow, who I actually had the privilege of meeting very briefly in New York once. And he was a real kind of rebel, wild, bad boy of New York and really quite dismissed at the time of his life because he was so kind of anti-establishment and he came from a very wealthy family. Can you speak a bit about the inclusion of him? And I like the fact that they're in this book because I think it really gives you a context of how these legacies are created.
Yeah.
Even like we both spent time and knew Amy Winehouse, the singer. And if you think about having spent time with someone in a room like we're doing right now in our lifetime, and then already there's a myth around her, for example, because their talent is so extraordinary and so great. But it's really interesting how that links, you know, to these artists that we might have met who are now, you know, becoming these kind of myths.
Yeah, I mean, I think I wanted to include Dash Snow because I think he stands for this really interesting period in history, which is like he's kind of like the last bohemian. You know, like he didn't engage at all with digital technology. He sort of comes to New York just as the Twin Towers fall. So he's kind of that disaffected youth. He's got a lot of Saddam Hussein imagery in his work. And he, you know, doesn't want email, doesn't want phone. His family are beyond wealthy. There's one of the great art patrons in history. They own the Rothko Chapel in Houston, right? It's like one of the most important places in art history to go and visit. And the DeMille family. And he sort of rejects all of that. He rejects really the art world. He doesn't even use art words. Like, he doesn't have sculptures. He has situations. And he just, you know, everything about him is a kind of complete refusal to obey in any way, shape, or form. And he almost sort of says, all the photographs I make are just really so I know where I was last night. But there's such an extraordinary snapshot into this kind of period in history. And it does feel like the end of an era. You know, when like you think about Mapplethorpe or Haring or Basquiat or whatever, and you read these books and you read that like they left messages for days to get in touch with each other, or they like went to a bar to try and find someone. Like, they didn't have mobile phones. They had no way of getting in touch. They had no social media. There's no website. They printed flyers and handed them on the street to get people to see their shows. And I find it so romantic and exciting. That's only like the 80s and the 90s. And he's like that last man standing who says, what are we giving into this stuff for? And that shows in his work, and he's kind of disdainful in his work. And so I was kind of attracted to him as this kind of marker between two centuries almost.
And another contemporary voice in there is Noah Davis, who also was the founder of the Underground Museum in Los Angeles. And I think the legacy of Noah's life and art, of course, which is just, again, transcendent. I mean, his skill for painting, but the work that he ended up creating is just something completely other. It's like soulfulness and just joy and love on the canvas. Can you speak a bit about including him? Because I think Noah's work is next level.
Yeah, how does it? When I first started writing the book, I put Noah Davis in the theme, which was about unfinished stories. So people like Khadija Say and Pauline Boaty and Joanna yes. Boyce Wells and Bartholomew Beale, people that we really need. This flame was new or small, and we had to. And then he got signed by David Zwirner, his estate, and I was like, okay, he should be fine now. He's amazing. And I kept seeing all these shows, and I was really pleased and excited, and this beautiful work done to share his legacy. But he was an extraordinary painter. He really is the kind of artist that is able to look all the way back through art history, but arrive somewhere totally new. Just so interesting. Like, there's this one painting of these two women on a sofa, and it just looks like they're like lazy Sunday afternoon. And then you realize that the entire space of the painting is unreal. There's this like Rothko painting in the background that's like dripping, like it's like defrosting ice cream or something. And the whole thing is so sort of otherworldly. And he paints and repaints and just fights so hard to make an interesting painting. And all his paintings are typically figurative, and they feature African-American people. And he's just so interested in representation, but representation of a kind I hadn't seen before. Mm-hmm. And as he finds out he has cancer, he creates this, he created it before with his wife and his brother and his sister-in-law, this thing called the Underground Museum, which was basically to put a museum into a kind of historically African-American, Latinx neighborhood, which is unserved by the cultural community, and to put on these shows. And he thinks these museums are going to lend to him, and he's writing all these letters, and they're like, we're not lending you work down there, mate. And in the end, he makes this amazing exhibition called The Imitation of Wealth, which is so money. He basically makes his own amazing artwork. So, like, he makes a fake Jeff Koons. He goes on Craigslist and buys a vacuum cleaner and puts it in a Perspex box. He makes, like, his fake Onkawara. Like, no one will lend in these works. And I'm going to make them. Puts them in the window. And, like, no one really saw this exhibition, but it's become this, like, folklore show. Yeah. And then eventually this woman called Helen Molesworth, who worked at the MoCA, said, okay, I'll lend you stuff. And the first show they decide to put on together is William Kentridge. This is an enormous artist.
Yeah.
And basically, on his hospital bed, he dies of this rare type of cancer in his 30s, early 30s. He programs, like, years and years and years worth of this museum.
And there's something like 18 exhibitions onwards.
But did they all get seen? Did they all
And like his basically what he created with those people that he loved is still the backbone of that space today, which is one of the important spaces in downtown LA, if not LA, if not the States, for what it stands for. Like, Solange Knowles has like her album launch party there. It means so much.
Yeah, and Barry Tompkins' film Moonlight was screened there, you know, for the first time. And it's really interesting, this idea of this kind of very positive endeavor with showing art in an underprivileged neighborhood, and then the impact that Helen Molesworth has, you know, coming from MoCA, being someone in power who actually sees that they can help make a change. And by making that connection between MoCA and the Underground Museum, it's actually an amazing blueprint, and it's literally transformed lives, because art has the power to change the way that people see themselves, how they feel that they are seen by society, you know, all kinds of things. And I think it does take, that's kind of what I was talking about before, about it's not always just the artist on their own. It's about the connections and the collaborations they have with curators, with collectors, with, you know, the audience, with different people. And I think it's a really wonderful thing that Helen did.
So many times in the book where the artist imagines the impossible and demands that society gives it, you know, and like they're young, they're all young. They never got to be old and cynical. They never got to have a bad period. They were all, you know, they all suspended in our minds as these young, forceful creatives. And that gives them a special power, actually. In writing it, I realized there is something that ties them all together. They were all great artists, but there's something about the fact that they're now forever suspended in us as these young creative people that's really exciting. And there's just tons of lessons. Like, if you want to think about how to revolutionize your small pocket, your big area, the art world en masse, then these guys have got some amazing strategies.
Absolutely. Well, what I want to say about this book as well is that it's not morbid at all. It's incredibly celebratory. I've got some
I hope
more...
so.
Oh, it totally is. Oh, my
but
God.
But it also makes you want to look at the art. Yeah, I feel like I mean, spent ages sure on the computer because there were so many things I'd never seen before.
Yeah.
So it sort of leads you to
I've got some more nuggets I want to throw out there. Toulouse-Lautrec. We've all heard of Toulouse-Lautrec.
No, who's Toulouse-Lautrec?
Did you know his parents were first cousins?
Wow.
There you go. Have that one. Yves Klein worked at an art framing shop in London and he lived in South Kensington.
Really?
Yep.
I never knew that.
Yeah, there you go.
I didn't read that.
But these are the nuggets I'm telling you
give
about.
Him an Yves Klein blue plaque. That's a bit of an in-joke.
Is there,
love that.
And is it in Yves Klein? Well, I guess that the blue London...
It's a really geeky joke. Thank you to you.
Yeah, well, Yves Klein had his own blue, didn't he, that he kind of kept for himself and everything. Yes, yes, Kate. One more. Anna Mendieta. Now, this is a bit more sad. She plummeted to her death from her apartment window and she was in a tumultuous relationship with the artist Carl Andre. And Carl Andre never got... He went to trial for it, didn't he? But he got away with it. But there's a whole movement of people to still believe that potentially... They had a kind of very dysfunctional relationship. She was like upbeat and firing outwardly, and he was very inward and introverted and angry. There's a conversation that he might have been the reason she fell out.
Yeah, there's lots of allegations. It's not proven. Yeah,
yeah, yes, no. Yes, I mean, yes. I think that there's what I think what's interesting is that the people who hold these placards outside museums saying "Where is Anna Mendieta?" It's about her being a spokespeople for people who are left out of. The narrative, you know, like that's what she stands for. So, yeah, there was a court case and he was acquitted. I think what they're doing now is sort of using Anna Mendieta to say, you know, why aren't these women artists on display? You know, why don't we... She's such an extraordinary feminist artist. But, you know, she's definitely one of the artists who in my lifetime has had loads more shows, loads more attention, lots more books. Right. And it feels like I'm... just really excited to be part of a positive change, like that wanting all of us to kind of revise the stories that we tell and the artists that we hear about, because the way that we treat art history, i.e. what's already gone before, is so important because it informs the way we treat what's happening now. And we can change the color of the water, as it were. We can like drive forward in a more inclusive way. We just need to look back with the same inclusive eyes. Those artists were all there. They were just left out of the books.
And there's also so many more that we still don't know.
Loads.
Well, an artist that you finish off the book on, it's an incredible moving story, it's an artist that you personally knew, called Bartholomew Beale. And he's an artist that when you started writing the book, you didn't realise that he was sick. And then towards the end of the book, he passed away.
Yeah, it was a real shock. He died at Christmas time. I started writing the book a couple of months before. And he was... And he was an artist that I sort of gave his break to, as it were. A few people were involved, and I was one of them. And he was the youngest artist ever to show at the Fine Arts Society, which is no mean feat, because it's like a 126-year-old gallery. And I was the director of contemporary, and I'd never shown an artist straight out of grad school before. And he went to Wimbledon. He's like the other Bardo of Wimbledon. He would have loved that. Was an incredible career, but a short career, 10 years. But he lived like every day was a gift. I mean, he was such a lesson in how to live and how to paint and how to be an artist and how to conduct yourself. I think of him all the time, actually, because I always try and think, like, when I'm in a really bad mood, and I think, Bartholomew wouldn't stand for this. You know, he would go and find the nearest sausage roll, even if it was just about
that's
to
not
to
a euphemism. No.
And he would, you know, he would just like, just get over it. And, you know, he was diagnosed with brain tumor when he was like in 19 or 20 or something, very early. I never knew that. I didn't give him his show as any kind of, I didn't know. And so he just lived his life, was an amazing artist, kept painting. All his shows would sell out. I was like, what's going on? This guy's, I'm going to sign up loads of graduates. This is easy. No, it's not. It doesn't happen. And I just think his paintings are so like haunting and soulful. He was this like really old head on young shoulders. And unfortunately, he just got sick again quite quickly and he died smiling. He was always smiling, surrounded by his family on Boxing Day. So it's just been a couple of years since he passed away. And well, no, not even that.
You work with the estate as well now.
Well, the family are working out, like, how do I protect these paintings? What do we do? And, you know, they're raising a lot of money for brain cancer research, which is amazing. Mm. And so, yeah, you know, I'm speaking to his parents, Amanda and Chris, and his brother Theo. He's got all these fantastic, brilliant brothers. And about, like, this very sensitive, delicate thing of, like, this guy made it. He painted. A lot of people live with these paintings, and they're the most extraordinary things. How do we make sure that the what he stood for and who he is continues? You know, and it's a privileged thing, but it was obviously a real shock to be writing this kind of book, and then for that to happen.
And also, I think it's the legacy of their work and how that then goes on to help future generations or even inspire other artists. Like, a number of times you talk about this idea of an artist, you know, artists that make work to inspire others. And I think that's one of the biggest, most generous acts, in a way, is to be able to inspire artists of your generation. Can we talk about one more artist before we go to other topics, like off outside of the book? But just, I discovered Amrita Shergill through your book.
Same.
And I don't know how, I never knew Amrita's work, but it is the most extraordinary work, and then also an extraordinary story of, like, a family's kind of dedication and love. And when you can spot maybe your child as a great musician or a great artist, and then you do everything you can to make opportunities for your child, in a way.
I mean, it's unbelievable. If your 16-year-old said, I want to go to Paris to study painting today, you'd be like, all right, love.
From India.
But she's, like, leaving India to go to Paris. She's 16. And it's,
well, the,
like,
whole family go.
Yeah, and it's like 1920 or something. I mean, it's like unbelievable. So she's got, she's Hungarian Indian. And what's interesting is that she turns up to Paris, and there's this, like, this way of making painting which looks at, like, primitive art, which is so fashionable. So people like Gauguin, traveling to Tahiti under colonial rule, treating the women there as other, and becomes incredibly fashionable. And so she's at art school there, and she assimilates very quickly. She's very gifted, and immediately is, like, in the exhibitions and is great, does really well. And of course she has this fascination with that kind of painting from an avant-garde painting perspective, but is also interested in it as a Indian woman in Paris who also occupies a space of otherness. So the fact that we don't necessarily all know her paintings, and that we're not seeing them every time we're seeing the other post-impressionists, for example. I mean, she comes later, but is such a missed opportunity, because it fills in all the blanks of, like, what is it to be a woman in that period and be looking at those women looked at and painted in that way? Mm. And she leaves Paris and then goes back to Lahore, and then creates this amazing kind of art scene around her there, and is sort of fantastically important. And, like, you know, her paintings not long ago sold for, like, over £1 million at auction, like her self-portrait. So she's, like, a sensationally important artist, but we just need to get this reputation sort of out of India into the rest of the world. The Tate had a show for her in 2007.
I know, which somehow I missed. But she was 28 when she died, and she was on the eve of having an amazing exhibition of her work, which made a huge impact in her home country.
And they sort of call her, like, the Frida Kahlo of India. You know, like, that's the story. And so, yeah, I'm sure Amrita Shergill, you're going to keep hearing that name now. Yeah.
But also, I think she chose to be an artist almost as a political thing. You know, she was rebelling against gender norms, against sexuality norms, all these kind of battles that she had, which is, I think, why she gets compared to Frida.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to go for a drink with her. I'd love to hang out with her. I'd love to go to do a studio visit. All of these artists, I would actually.
Yeah, you can
feel
their passion.
You go to New Delhi in India, the National Gallery of Modern Art there has a humongous collection of her work. So we are here in Soho House. You are head of collections at Soho House. When did you take that job on? How did you get that job? What is that job like?
I've been doing it now for 5 years, five very happy years. And it's like not working for a living. I just love it. I mean, I really do. I get to meet artists all over the world. I get to come up with these crazy curatorial concepts and make them come to life. I get to go to do the studio visits, you know, and it's global, right? So I know loads of artists in Mumbai. It's like, I never thought that would be the case. And I know critics and curators who...
Oh, because there's a Mumbai Soho House. So how does that work? So if they say, right, we want to put art in Soho House? Do you make it local to where the Soho House is?
Yeah, I mean, it depends where we are in the world, and I come up with different ways of doing it. But like in Hong Kong, where I used to live, I really felt like the Hong Kong artists were unrepresented slightly in the community there, because everybody uses Hong Kong as a way to kind of show Western art to the mainland Chinese, for example, and China to the rest of the international community. And the Hong Kongers, you know, who are making really important work, are being overlooked slightly. And that's changing, of course, and there's amazing museums opening. But I wanted our collection to be part of that change. So it's so specific. You have to be literally born or based in Hong Kong, nowhere else, to be in that collection.
But do you have researchers on the ground there, or is this work that you personally have to do?
It's just me, this like crazy woman running around the world. Yeah.
So how do you?
That's why I look so tired, guys.
How do you do that? So say like Mumbai, you go out to Mumbai and then.
Well, I mean, there are people who work with me on my team, and we work with all these. You know, one of the best resources is artists.
Yeah,
you know,
ask an artist.
Ask an artist. Yeah. Who do you love? You know, I asked Bhatti Kerr, one of the most important artists based in Delhi, and she gave me this fabulous list. The artists are very generous, particularly women artists are very generous with their lists. And we speak to people running museums and galleries, and I go to the art fairs just loads and loads of research. And then you whittle it down to what you're looking for. And we want to be representative. So we have like emerging artists, artists who didn't go to school, all the way through to, you know, artists in the 70s and 80s. Yeah. And we, you know, and I get quite excited by the thrill of like putting Tracy, your great friend, Tracy Emin, on the wall next to this like young graduate, and it gets photographed. And it's like, that's quite an unusual opportunity, actually.
Do they get membership with that as well?
So that's the premise of the collection. It's this like great column door system, so we exchange, so the artists get membership and contra to spend at Soho House, and we get their artwork and the members get to enjoy it. And it's just this, I love it because it kind of sidesteps the rampant
gallery
commercial
system.
beast of the art world. And we include galleries, of course, but we want the artists in the houses. You know, they're, you know, the backbone of the creative community, arguably, and it's exciting for us to have the artists in the spaces because they speak so much of that city. We just opened Paris, or just about to open Paris, and it's really thrilling to see all these young artists turn up and see it for the first time, look for their painting and go, oh yes, I know her, and like see who else is in the collection, who were they next to. And yeah, it's like the first day at school. I love it.
It's also great to think that you can go out for dinner within the Soho House group, and then all around you there's loads of life stories and different, even the way that you've curated here in BBC Television Centre. This is obviously the historic kind of centre of British broadcasting, but you have the whole Tony Hart inspired wall. And for those who don't know, Tony Hart, when we were kids in the 80s, was like the guy who did Heartbeat.
Or Vision On earlier.
We were Heartbeat kids.
Remember Morph was there, wasn't
it? Yes, Morph, exactly. Yeah. My legend, my icon.
Love Morph.
But I loved Tony Hart when we were growing up. And then you contacted loads of artists and said, look, I'm doing a theme on Tony Hart. What did he mean to you?
Yeah, it's the best bit about my job to just have this kind of crazy idea and then ask all these people you really respect, like, do you want to do this? And they go, yeah. Like, I think artists are so great. And they're also, you know, it's fun when you come up with these kind of curatorial games, experiments, because they also don't get the opportunity to do that often. Like, we asked artists to make these single line continuous drawings for 40 Greek Street, like, so it's like Paul Clay. We said, don't let the pencil come off the page. And it was really sweet because like someone like Yinka Shona Bear did it perfectly. And I was like, oh, do you want me to video me doing it? Like, I didn't video it. I did do it in one line.
Ultimate skill.
I was like, it's not an exam, dude. And, you know, and then there were other artists that just, like, totally broke the rules. And it was like, you know, Jake and Dinos Tapman took, like, a dot to dot and, you know, from a children's colouring in book. And it was about how the artists would break the rules. But for Tony Hart, it was really fun because it came from a conversation with an artist, actually, Michael Landy, an artist I love so much. British artist, told me that he had submitted work. So the premise of Tony Hart was like a children's television show for art, treated children's art seriously, which I think it should be treated seriously. And you could send your art in, and there was like a jury, I suppose, people who worked on the show, and they would decide whose art got to go on telly, which is like the ultimate...
You sent art in as well.
Oh, yeah, I sent in some really bad art. And then I discovered that Michael Landy was sending his art in. So, like, you know, Anthony Gormley or Damien Hirst, these people sending in their art. And then the BBC were receiving so much, they were just destroying it. And so,
they destroyed an Anthony Gormley. You know, they're going to regret that now.
Yeah. So many artists. And so I think what's fascinating is then I asked the artist if you'd make something for Tony Art, who had passed away. He was on TV for like 50 years. So it was like our little homage to him. And it was like our opportunity to be on the gallery wall. Obviously, I didn't put my art in, but I curated it. So I was like, I'm in. I got on it. And then some of the artists actually gave me work that they made when they were kids, got it down from the loft. Sue Webster, Michael Landy, and Matt Collishaw all gave stuff they made when they were young, which is such an amazing privilege to be the custodian of these works, a part of their sort of history. It's so sweet. And so putting things together like that is really fun.
And there's one with the Blue Peter badge. It's like a gold Blue Peter badge.
Are
ship.
You going to say you've got a Blue Peter badge?
I do. Yeah. I have a Blue Peter badge, which I found recently, and I posted on Instagram last Christmas because I was on my own for Christmas and had nothing else to do. So I was just showing
you've
off.
Your Blue Peter
and
badge
I don't just have one Blue Peter badge. I have two. I have a silver one, which is like when you're really special. Thanks. And I met Biddy Baxter, who is the editor. She
do
was
you want,
a legend.
Do you want a round of applause?
She was, yes, thank you. Thank you.
There we go. But you have so many artworks in the collection now. Some of them are probably worth a lot of money. There's a two Lynette Yarden Beatties. You have a Peter Doig. How does that work with the collection now? Are you allowed to loan these works out to exhibitions? And how does it work with insurance? And how do you stop people from nicking them off the wall?
Oh my God, that's true. Like drunken members.
Yeah, well, I like that. I love that.
Oh my God.
So put it in your Birkin.
That's an art heist.
Bush.
Yes, guys, come on. They're all security fitted to the building. We have all of those things in place that you would have in place, CCTV, all of those kind of things. But to be honest with you, you know, as history shows with people stealing Van Goghs from Barry, you know, like art needs to be seen. So every time you put an artwork on display, it's the kind of, I can't think of the phrase. We want these works to be seen all the time by members. Nothing in our collection is in storage.
Well, that's the reason they exist.
Exactly. That's the reason they exist. And so we kind of feel like we exist outside of the art market. So of course we're sensitive to these things. We care about these works so much. We care about conservation. We care about their well-being. But ultimately they're for the members, right? So they have to be seen. They have to be enjoyed. You know, the National Gallery has to show the sunflowers, the most important painting in the world, arguably. So I think that it's just the great privilege of having this collection, but it's also hard work. We want you to be able to dance next to a Rashid Johnson. We want you to be able to sort of send your morning emails with your coffee, you know, next to Tracy Emin or, you know, Lynette, like, or Oscar Murillo. They're there in the collection. And I think the artists like that because they don't want to be in storage. And also I think the artists like the collection sometimes, they tell me, because they get to see the work again. Of course, if you're an artist and you make a sale, great. But you might never see that again. True. And you might have, that be blood, sweat, and tears. And the thing about coming into our collection and collections like it is that you get to keep living with it and you get to see other people looking at it. You know, I love it when I come to the house somewhere and I see an artist and they always sit under their work. It's
no.
So cute. So cute. And I just, and that's my dream. I know you do that, Sharon. I can see you in the front row.
It's your one.
Yeah.
Yeah,
sit underneath it.
Yeah.
Do you sort of go like,
I would. And I think that's one of the great, beautiful things about collection. It's like, we call it, it's like a working collection. It's not a show horse. She's out to work every day.
But also, it's the members' collection in a way. And if you're a member here and you don't necessarily have the money to buy your own art or whatever, it's a way that you can sort of live with
Absolutely.
Art. And that's such a wonderful
that's
thing.
The point of it. Yeah, we have the artists in the houses as part of the community and the members, these are their homes, we hope. And so, yeah, this is like, you know, a bit of a wicked little art collection.
As a gallerist, I've always really respected the Soho House collection because I've noticed that over the past 12 years that I've been working in art, you've always supported the artists before they're well known. So yes, you have like Lynette Yarden Beatties' paintings, but you got them when she wasn't famous. You know, it's like, and that gift, it kind of that belief that you put, you know, putting these young artists on the walls next to big artists who like Peter Doig or whoever, it really does spur people on to
I think
making work.
The collection was the brainchild really of Johnny Yeo, great artist, friend of Nick Jones, who and I think it was always, the premise was that it was really for the kind of art community, this connection. You know, no one was really doing anything. We don't sell anything. We loan to museums, sure, but, and so it had this sort of like, it written into its DNA, and Francesca Gavin, who took over from Johnny.
Yeah, she's amazing.
An amazing curator, And it, you know, I inherited this collection really from her, and I was like, just blown away by how sensitively she curated it and sort of hoped that I could sort of carry on in that tradition and take it forward and expand it and be try and be more ambitious, actually. You know, all the time I'm trying to be ambitious. Oh, my God. You know, I get myself into such difficult situations. Like, okay, so you were going to do this and then we're going to do this. And like, I definitely make it harder for myself. But I'm always trying to push what we can deliver and how we can change expectations, you know. And so House, I think, is always pushing, and we want to do that too with the arc that goes into the spaces. So, more murals and putting, you know, we've got light-based installation here and trying to get...
Well, in Berlin, you have the Damien Hirst shark on the wall, don't you? That's a mural, that's a permanent.
Yeah, and, you know, we've just had an artist called Miranda Forrester, who's a young graduate that I really support her practice. I think she's a sensational artist for Brighton.
What's her name?
Miranda Forrester.
Write that down, everyone.
She has just done this. She's an amazing painter and has designed all these beautiful fabrics for us for the parasols of Brighton. And in her hands, they're work of art. You know, they're just so exciting to let an artist loose.
Yeah.
And so that's just a thrilling thing to be able to do, you know, and that we're in touch with so many, I mean, hundreds of artists at any one time. It's just.
Where's the next location?
Well, at the moment, we're just installing Rome. I just flew back yesterday.
What was that like?
It's so exciting.
I love going to Rome because that's like the centre of all art history.
Yeah, exactly. And all the artists wanted to be in it. It's a very Italian collection. And we have this theme going called...
So you've got Leonardo's and Michelangelo's.
Oh, yeah. Raphael. But we've got this theme about saints and sinners, which is really interesting to see how artists take saints and sinners. So there's work that responds to the migrant crisis. There's work that responds to ancient mythology, religion, of course, to Brexit. I mean, it's not necessarily obvious looking at them, but the artists are so interesting and socially politically activated in a lot of their practices that all these threads theme through it. So it becomes this interesting snapshot of like, what is it to be a saint and what is it to be a sinner in this moment in time?
Amazing.
Looking forward to going there. I also really want to go and see Sharon Walter's work.
I want to sit under
180
it.
The Strand.
Yeah.
Future Talk Art guest, hopefully. I love her. Big fan.
So you must have listened to Talk Art. Have you listened to Talk Art?
Of course I've listened to it. Every time I go in my downstairs loo, I think of Michael Stipe. My house is like, when I do all my let me unpack. When I decorated my house, I listened to Talk Art almost exclusively. And
I have proof. I have text messages of you saying,
exactly.
I'm doing this room now and I'm listening to this
and
episode.
So like, I think of Billy Childish when I lay in the bath and I see how badly I painted the black bit on the fireplace because you were talking to Billy Childish at the time and I'm like, look how wonky that is, Billy Childish. I have such a visual memory. Or like, there was raining during lockdown. I was under this tree in Brockwell Park, and for me, that tree is Jerry Saltz's tree because he's like chatting away to me and I'm hiding from the rain. No, I had, that's probably one of my great secret weapons, is I have a very strong visual memory, so your words echo in these strange places. So yes, I listen.
Well, as someone who listens, you know that we ask every guest two questions.
Yes.
And now we're going to ask them to you, Kate Bryan.
I know.
The first question is, if you could do an art heist and responsibly, obviously.
Well, actually, two ways. If you could do an art heist and responsibly steal any work of art in the world, but if you could have an art heist of any work of art in any Soho house around the world, what would it be and why?
I just can't answer this. Can I flip it slightly? Let me just ask, can I take a work from a private collection
and make it
public?
Public, we'd love
so
that.
So I would like to
take it away from
the... Because when I go into like the National Gallery or the Tate with anybody, I get like goosebumps and almost a bit shaky explaining, you know that these belong to the nation and they're free and you can see them anytime you want. And they're like, all right, calm down. Like, and so the idea for me of like, if I can change the rules would be to like, there's this Oscar Murillo painting that I saw he painted during lockdown, and a great friend of mine owns it. So sorry to her. I'm going to nick it. It's called Neoliberal. It's just, it is everything you need to know if you want to know why painting's still relevant. This painting is just a knockout. And I would put that on permanent display so loads and loads of people can see it. I think he is just such
an
important artist.
Have you told your friend that you want to do this?
She knows that I'm kind of... I keep sort of turning up uninvited to have a cup of coffee to look at
with
it. I'm basically doing it.
Yeah.
And as for Soho House, I mean, it's such an amazing job that it's like picking between your children, honestly, the work that I've acquired. One work that sticks out for me, and I suppose it's because... Rob is Billy Childish at Amsterdam, you know, that self-portrait that he made where he's in the guise of Van Gogh. It was a collection that asked artists to respond to Dutch art history and specifically to make a self-portrait in homage to Rembrandt, the great self-portraitist. Yeah. But of course, Van Gogh made loads of great self-portraits, so Billy went with this. And I just loved the sort of the layering of art history in that painting. And so the one that I just think of this second... is not to play favourites. Of all the 5,000 works that we have in the collection, is just that one at this moment.
Amazing. It's very personal.
Yeah. Aww. And you represent him.
Yeah.
Good.
And I did the deal.
We did the deal together.
Yeah, I connected it all. I linked up the artist.
Not nepotistic at all.
No.
So what is your favourite colour, Kate Bryan, and why?
Oh, I think that's...
It's okay.
I'm not the first person to complain, and I won't be the last. Get over yourself. Adam Bridgeland made this amazing artwork called My Favourite Colour is Rainbow. And I have that at home, actually. It's in my daughter's room. So that's one answer. Another answer would be yellow because of Van Gogh, because he kind of communicated joy and hope through the sunflowers, through that use of yellow, which was so clever. You know, after the Second World War, 5,000 people queued a day to go and see the sunflowers after the Second World War. I mean, it was such an emblem of hope. And so, and I think that yellow... And all of the yellows in that painting speak so powerfully of something that can connect us. So I'll go with yellow.
Yellow is the colour of madness.
As well, incidentally. I didn't want to break that to you because I was actually going to say the same thing.
Another question, one more question then. So what is the best piece of advice you've had when it comes to your job, whether it be as a presenter because you're a regular on Sky Arts and BBC 2 and 4, as a curator, what's the best advice you've ever received?
I think actually someone who I work for at the British Museum is the deputy director, a guy called Andrew Burnett, and I was his PA for a while. And I wanted to apply for this job, which would have taken me out of his sort of administrative realm and into the curating realm where I wanted to go. And I was like, I'll never get it, but it'll be good experience to apply for it, right? And he just sort of looked at me like I was mad. And he was like, you really shouldn't underestimate yourself. And I'm really sorry to everybody that I sort of like will not stop talking about art to. But he told me not to underestimate myself, so now I won't shut up about art.
Aww. That's great. Well, there we go. That's amazing advice.
Well, thank you for everything you do for art as well, because you do it in so many different ways as well. You're so multifaceted, and don't stop writing because your books are brilliant.
Yeah, this book is
You're all going to explore tonight when you get home.
Yes.
And you can read Kate's book. Very exciting.
But this is a gift to all the legacies.
Also this extraordinary book, guys, who everybody I know has received it from me as a present. It's now the de facto birthday present. Aww. Talk Art. Everything you wanted to know about contemporary art but were afraid to ask. This was a beacon of light during lockdown, and it continues to be such an important book for so many people. You took Talk Art onto mainstream news and TV in this country. Like, you really, really took art to the people who want it and deserve it. So well done.
Hearing you say that is such a sense of relief, because we haven't really been in a room with people with our book much because of lockdown. It came out in the middle of lockdown. We couldn't see anyone. And I was so terrified about that book. I thought it was going to destroy everything. I thought it was I don't know, because I never really wanted to write a book. And it was so weird when we did it.
Can I just give you a piece of advice?
Yeah.
Don't underestimate yourself.
Yeah. Thanks, Kate. Yeah. Anyway,
we're going to go to a Q&A in this room, but we've got everyone who's watching. Millions and millions of people worldwide are watching this on a live stream if they're awake. But we're going to say goodbye.
I heard that the app is a social network thing.
Oh, yes. Yeah, really cool. I think people have been communicating and chatting, poking each other.
There might even be a Talk Art, wedding happening if two people have messaged each other while they were listening.
Talk Art wedding.
We'd like
love
a Talk
that.
Art wedding, please.
Yes, but we're going to say, we're going to open the room up for an intimate Q&A here, but we're going to say goodbye to everyone. If you're watching, go to @TalkArt on Instagram. You can follow us @KateBryan.
I think it's KateBryan_art.
There we go, KateBryan_art on Instagram for Kate. All images are going to be on our feed. Please get these books. Please get a Talk Art book and Kate's book, Art of Love, and Bright Stars, all available now. And thank you very much, everyone.
Thanks for listening. Bye.
Well, that stops. So if anyone's got Q&A, we've got a Q&A now. So if anyone's got any lovely questions.
So on the social media app thing that they've created, the house app, there's lots of people apparently giving questions as well. Or you guys can ask questions. That would be more fun, maybe.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, there we go.
Is there a mic, or are we going to use one of ours?
Is there a roving mic, or are you just shouting out? Are you going to stand up? You have to come to the middle of the room.
You have to come to, especially because it's you. We know this person. We know that person.
Shout.
Thank you. It's so good. If you could spend an hour with anybody that you've written about in your new book, who would it be, and what would you ask?
Your question is meaner than theirs. the last question, I mean. I would, looking at it now, trying to remember who's in it. Who would I spend time with? I guess I need to spend time with someone who's still a bit of a mystery to me, right? So I can try and really...
Well, Vermeer, you said that not a lot of people know about Vermeer at all, the person.
Yeah, he's still a mystery. I guess I'm going to give you two answers. I'd spend an hour with Bartholomew Beale just to make sure he really knew how special he was.
Oh.
I hope he did. And I would spend... Do you know what? I'd spend an hour with Jean-Michel Basquiat because why on earth not? I want to see him painting, writing, eating, scribbling phone numbers on his paintings and living and breathing art and redefining what it is to be a young artist.
What would you ask him? I think was the second part of the question.
What would I ask him? I'd ask him about his work. I wouldn't ask him about the market. I wouldn't ask him how he felt to be the Black Picasso, which people asked him in a really demeaning way. I would ask him just about the work. And maybe I wouldn't ask him anything. He's probably sick of people talking to him. I'd probably just be quiet and just watch and try not to be a pain.
Offer
him
membership.
Yeah, I'd be like, right, I'm going to give you global membership. Yeah.
Any more questions?
Oh, hello.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I suppose it's one that I'm still working out as I'm coming, you know, sharing the book with people. I suppose one of the things that's really exciting is that we just have a more sensitive, nuanced society now. If you take the issue of mental health, for example, you take the issue of Black Lives Matter or Me Too, that there is just an enormous number of people walking this planet that absolutely refuse to allow the status quo to continue. And hopefully we're driving forward. And so, you know, if you think about the prism by which we can view Van Gogh now with a much more sensitive understanding of what it is to live with an illness which occupies your mind, then hopefully that allows us to see his work in a better way. So I think we're kind of doing work outside of the art world, which will hopefully give you know, a greater sensitivity to the way that we look at these artists and who we include, you know. So things like Black Lives Matter, you know, like Basquiat before Black Lives Matter was like the most record-breaking exhibition in the Barbican, you know, like 200,000 people more went to see that show, and yet he's like not in any UK permanent institutions. The museums in the States don't even have that many. When he died, everyone was like he was just a star of the art market and sort of didn't want to touch him, as you were saying. People, the market got nervous. It's like, I don't care about the market, let the art speak for itself. And people voted with their feet and they went to see that show. So, you know, if you read about an exhibition in the newspaper and you're like, oh, that's someone who I should know about, go and see the show. It matters. You know, buy the catalogue. Like, I think we can all be part of saying, no, I vote by my presence that I want to see more like this. Give people something they can't say no to.
I also really feel strongly as a gallerist that you need to look out for your, if you're working in any field, really, even your friends, whatever, we all need to look out for each other more and sort of check in with each other and make sure everyone's all right. Because I think, particularly in the art world, being an artist is such a solitary pursuit, and you can often spend days by yourself making work. And that drive that we see in your book, you know, is a common thread between all those individuals, is something that's real right now. You know, there are very driven, possessed artists who spend so much time by themselves. And I think it's really important to check in with them and make sure they're okay, you know. And that might sound cheesy or something, but I think it's really serious. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. He looked like he's going to ask a question.
We thought you were going to ask a question.
Yeah.
No fear,
just,
everyone.
You got a question?
Just come up with a question.
Just open your mouth. What's going to come out? You're so tired. Here we go. Here's a question. Let's move away from that. Yeah. It is. Well, we did a whole episode with someone about the NFTs, which was, we felt really proud of that because it was on the cusp of people crap having the big Christie's auction. And it's something that I feel like personally, generationally, we are struggling with because we've known a world without the internet. But if you've grown up with the internet and that's all you know, to suddenly see works that are digital, they don't feel like they're this separate entity and they're not worthy of being seen on the same level because that's all you've known. You live online. So why do these digital works not mean as much as a physical work suddenly? So I can understand that. And I also feel like it's a lot of people... The world is moving quickly and it's a lot of people trying to hold back on it or trying to understand it. And when there's money being made, I think there's a lot of angry people going, hang on a minute, someone knows more than me and they're making money out of it. I need to do that. If NFTs were making no money, if that wasn't the main kind of headline of NFTs, there wouldn't be as much stress or anger towards them.
But I also feel like, though, if it wasn't linked to money, it would be, it is a really fascinating platform. It's a great, it's just like, you know,
video
oil
art,
paint is a medium. It's a medium, of course. And I think if the intention behind it is rigorous and the artist is really invested in what they're doing. What I'm not into about it at the moment is the hype around it and the idea that, like, someone actually told me yesterday, oh, my friend yesterday made this amount of money equivalent or whatever yesterday. People are already talking about it as in how much money someone
made
in
just
the day.
Bitcoin.
That's not art to me. Money is not art. Like, it's not interesting. And the artist that often...
And you say that as a dealer.
No, but that's the whole point. I love artists.
Babe. I know.
And I want to support artists so that they can make money and, you know... and live and feed their families and feed themselves and pay tax and be a responsible citizen. Like, I don't think selling art is necessarily an evil thing. And I don't think NFTs are evil. What I don't like is stocks and shares and all that stuff when it's like, you know, when art is reduced
I don't
that.
Think it's settled yet. I think when it settles and suddenly there's these artists, you go like, oh, okay, you can see their work and understand in practice, then we'll be in a better position. But right now it feels like it's just come out of nowhere and it's changing the game.
Yeah, I agree. I think we need to let the dust settle, stop talking about money. There must be a way that you can use this to allow people to come into the art world who are otherwise excluded.
Exactly, which is a great thing.
Yeah, let's let people hijack it for the better of the art world, hopefully.
And there's also been people who have been selling NFTs recently for the greater good, so they're raising extraordinary sums of money. Like, I mean, hundreds of thousands, 800,000. Yeah, exactly. And then they give the money to charity.
That's all
and
the stuff that excites me.
That kind of idea of NFTs and the internet
Incredible.
And social change, there's huge potential in.
Guys, can I ask you a question?
Oh, yeah.
Will you sign my book?
No, sorry.
Sent you a signed book.
It was signed, but I...
Oh, actually dedicated?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
Of course.
The answer is yes.
Of course. And for everyone else who buys one now, absolutely.
Really?
We'll sign it, won't we?
No, I'm up for that.
Yeah, if you buy one, we're signing.
Love that.
Might just have one signature, apparently.
Yes. You're not going to sign them?
No, I am going to sign them.
Oh, okay. Right.
I'm up for it.
All right, good.
I love signing books.
Any more questions? Oh, you've got a question.
Oh, you do have
a
question.
So you're tired? You're suddenly telling us why you're tired?
I'm taking it all in. It's fantastic.
Great. I'm falling asleep.
You mentioned Instagram being a platform now. Is there someone alive now that you're following that we should go home and look into that's inspired you recently?
Oh, loads.
Wait, can I quickly just answer? Basically, Tracy Emin recently joined Instagram as Tracy Emin Studio because before it was done by like her gallery team her studio team because she was sick, obviously, with cancer and recovering, so she didn't really have time to update her Instagram publicly. But the writing that she does with each post is extraordinary. And I'm her friend and I'm learning every day. I like read them and I'm like, she's extraordinary. Like the way
she's
that she
such
writes.
A welcome addition. It's
yeah,
so
and I'm so happy she's
her.
On Instagram. Yeah. And apparently in like a few weeks, she had like 50,000 followers already.
Of course
already.
She did.
But it's not enough. I want her to get like millions. So everyone
she
follow
will.
Tracy.
She will. Yeah. I think, there's a lot. I find artists on Instagram actually through sort of connecting with other artists. I found Sharon on Instagram last year, in fact. I think, I feel like I've got a name like 5,000 or name none. I mean, there's so many. I used to do these little videos on my Instagram to introduce people to new young artists. I feel really guilty that I don't do them anymore. It's not lockdown. I've got to get on the tube now.
We interviewed Oscar Yeho the other day.
Yeah.
His Instagram's amazing.
Yeah.
He is originally from Liverpool, based in New York now, but I love the way that he's posting on Instagram and the whole, he's actually creating a myth around himself in a weird way. Like
I think it is part of
the... It's really interesting.
There's a young artist that I'm mentoring at the moment called Kay Gazee, who's just about to be our artist in residence at the Soho Studio that opens this week on the King's Road in London. And he's amazing. I discovered him at the other art fair, actually. And Sarah Maple is an artist who's I just love so much. Actually, Robert knows her work as well. And I'm very invested in her Instagram and her as an artist and her as a person.
Oh, Jade Montserrat.
Yes.
Who you did an on IG Live with.
I did.
I love her Instagram and I think she's a brilliant force. And Lindsay Mendick
Lindsay's
is a
great
total character on Instagram. Yeah. You might even get like late night karaoke sessions with her boyfriend.
Yeah. Eliza Hopewell does like these amazing dance sessions. And yeah, like I really like the way artists are embracing Instagram. It's really interesting.
Yeah. There you go.
You're not giving away your Instagram tips. It's interesting.
Oh, all right. Well, Durant Langberg, Salman Tor, loads.
It's just too many.
Jade Fadejatimi.
Yeah.
Cassie Nomoda.
Oh, Cassie Nomoda is so good. She is exquisite at the way she communicates with the world through visual language and through her own image as an artist. She is, like, to me, up there with Frida Kahlo in the way that she presents.
Ooh, okay.
No, she is so extraordinary, and she's coming to Margate to see me. And
what?
I cannot get it's top secret. She's coming. Well, it's not anywhere. I've just told the whole world. But she's coming to Margate, and she's going to stay, and I love her.
Where is she going to stay?
I'm not going to talk to you about this. It's top secret. She's my friend. Thank you. Love Cassie.
Next question.
Wait. And on Instagram, you can message the artist. So don't be shy. If you love them, like, write to them. Because I wrote to Cassie, and then Cassie wrote back, and now we're hanging out.
Any other questions at all? Ah, yes.
My question relates to NFTs as well, and also the amazing work you're doing. I know that from the outside, NFTs look like it was hype, and people making millions of pounds. But I think a really attractive part of NFTs is really to the democratization of the art industry, people who otherwise wouldn't have gotten into these prestigious galleries. And I know that from the outside, the art world can look very elitist and inaccessible. So considering that you're doing work in shedding light on these amazing underrepresented artists, do you think the traditional art world is doing enough at the moment to make the art world accessible and approachable?
I think we're living through a big moment of change for sure. I mean, like, if you just look at the way that institutions are rehanging their permanent collections to include women artists permanently, or like making sort of extraordinary acquisitions. There was museums in the States which are selling work by people like Rothko in order to be able to transform the representation of artists in their collection. I mean, people have come up with really controversial sometimes ways of addressing the sort of historic inequality of their collections, and in a way that we haven't really seen before. And I don't think it's going away. So I feel really excited about that. I have this lecture that I roll out sometimes. Will women artists catch up in my lifetime? And when I first wrote it, I was a bit doom and gloom, and I'm feeling pretty good about it now. But I think that we are living through a momentous period of change. I think that things like Instagram and things like social media and holding power to account, which we're doing more and more, will hopefully sort of just take us to a place where we've got inclusivity as part of our DNA, I hope. But then I am the eternal optimist.
And we've spoken to so many different artists from around the world on the podcast. And one of the things a few people, I think Lubaina Hamid mentioned it, I can't remember who else, maybe Glenn Ligon, I'm not sure, but a few different artists we met who were talking about these steps forward, which seem like these giant leaps suddenly, and everyone's thrilled and everyone's talking about these developments. And then suddenly, like a year later, it's like 25 steps back. And that's what we have to commit ourselves to individually, because I think the more of us that commit, like within the art world, within the music world, within all industry, to support people of color, to support LGBTQ plus artists, to support women, to support, because that is where the future is. It's like different points of view are important. They should not be shut down, because actually we can all grow, you know, alongside, you know, heteronormative ways of living or whatever. But I just feel like that's the key, is for us to remember this isn't just a hype moment. It has, for change to actually happen, you have to commit to it.
Great. I think you're all free to go.
They're not, though, are they? Because we're going to be signing books.
Oh, yeah. Well, you have to queue up for your book.
You have to live here now.
You're moving in with us.
It wouldn't be bad to live in Soho now.
Talkart Towers. We always dreamt of Talkart Towers.
Thanks, everyone, for coming. It's been really
fun.
Yeah, thank you, Kate. We love you.
Thank you, Kate.
So happy we finally did it. No waters this time to break.
You've been listening to Talkart with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talkart, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talkart at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.